Welcome to Ex Libris, the premier podcast where the latest scientific discoveries are discussed in the context of their apologetic significance to the Christian faith. This program is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit reasons.org/monthly partners.
This is Average Joe Aguirre in the library of Dr. Jeff Zwirink, astrophysicist at Reasons to Believe, and we are here today to discuss the discovery of 7 Earth-sized planets. Jeff, some of these are reported to be in the sweet spot, the habitable zone, so let's find out if that is indeed the case.
Well, it is the correct that 3 of the planets around this star are in the habitable zone. And again, just to be explicit and clear about that, what the habitable zone is that if you look at how much radiation Earth receives, that we can figure out how much more radiation a planet could receive or how much less radiation a planet could receive and still have it be possible that there's liquid water on the surface of the planet. And so these are boundaries that scientists have been able to determine. And you actually can calculate it for every star. So certain stars give off more light and less light. And so that region where you're going to receive that amount of radiation where it's possible for liquid water is going to be different from for each type of star. But we could, I mean, that's just a straightforward calculation. And so they've gone and looked at this particular star, said, all right, where's too much radiation and that's clearly going to boil all the oceans, or too little radiation and everything's going to clearly be frozen. And then in between that, it's at least possible that liquid water could be there. And right. So they found 3 planets that are Earth-sized, which is the unique aspect of this system. 3 of those planets that are Earth-sized that are in that region where liquid water is possible, or it's at least possible given what we know for liquid water to exist on all these right. planets.
Okay, we'll get into that in a little bit. But first, let's get some particulars. The name of the star, where it is, and so on. And I believe there are 7 total, correct?
Yeah, well, there's 6 for sure. There's 7th likely, and it's around this star called TRAPPIST-1. It's TRAPPIST-1. And that has, it's some, there's an instrument that has that name to it. It's just, I think, the first image or first system that they found where they had this. If I remember correctly, they were using the Spitzer telescope to actually do the observation. So I think TRAPPIST has some relevant, or that has Spitzer in there somewhere. And it's a relatively close, I want to say it was 40 light years away, 12 parsecs away. So that's kind of in our neighborhood. I mean, the closest star is only 4 light years away. So this is about a factor of 10 away from the closest star. So it makes it something that's a little easier to study. Because once you get far, or I mean, the further away you get, the more resolution you have, the better, just the better equipment you have to be able to see what's going on. And so it's kind of exciting that it's close enough that we might be able to make some more detailed measurements with Hubble in the future or something like that. So the system that's found, it's called TRAPPIST-1. It's a ultra cool dwarf is what it's called. If I remember correctly, it's got a mass 8% the mass of the sun. So this is a very, very light star. It's
light as in dim?
Light as in doesn't have a lot of mass. I mean, only 8% the mass of the sun. You know, most stars out there have between, if you stay away from the dwarf category, it's kind of like, half a solar mass up to 10, 20, 30 to 100 solar masses. And so we're talking 8, 10%.
Okay.
That's a very light star. It's kind of on that borderline where if you get much smaller than that, then there's not enough gravitational pull to actually ignite nuclear fusion in its core. So this is on the light end of stars
here.
You could
kick it around like a hot ball, huh?
Well, maybe not kick it, but yes, it's an unusual star in that sense. And so, what I have noticed is that a trend is that the lighter the star is, the more likely it is to have smaller planets. And so the fact that there's a whole bunch of Earth-sized planets, in some sense, isn't really surprising to me because you only get the larger planets tend to come around the larger stars because there was more stuff there to make stars and planets. And so you get larger planets and more dust and gas, whereas these are smaller. So, yeah.
Nonetheless, it got a lot of buzz, Jeff. You mentioned,
it really did, yeah.
You mentioned that 3 of them are in that possible liquid water habitable zone. Why? Why do scientists think that it could harbor liquid water?
Well, again, the reason being is that it's the temperature on the surface of the planet that determines whether it can have liquid water or not. And if it's too hot, the water evaporates. If it's too cold, all the water freezes. And so that's determined by at least a couple of things. But the only thing we can measure is how much radiation it receives from the star. So the closer is a planet to a star, the more radiation it receives. The farther a planet is from a star, the less radiation it receives. And so beyond some distance, it's going to be too cold and it's going to be frozen. Within some distance, it's going to be too hot and all the water will evaporate. And in between those two regions, depending on the type of atmosphere, and that's a very key point, depending on the type of atmosphere, it's possible for the surface to be at the right temperature where liquid water could exist. So, for example, if you take our planet and get rid of its atmosphere, even though it's in the habitable zone, it would be far too cold and all the water would be frozen. If you take our planet and put a very dense carbon dioxide atmosphere, it's going to get very hot and all the water will evaporate. And so it's critical what kind of atmosphere it has. So that's why, you know, I make that distinction that it's possible for there to be water, but that's one of one requirement. It's got to get at least enough radiation, but it also has to have the right type of atmosphere. So even within that habitable zone, if it doesn't have the right kind of atmosphere, it could be entirely frozen or entirely all the water's evaporated.
So that's an important distinction right there. Just because it's, quote, in that habitable zone, without that correct atmosphere, forget it. It's over.
Exactly. And, you know, I wrote an article on our website called What Is Habitable Mean? Just for that reason, is that what we talk about habitable are the things that we can actually measure. And right now, all we can measure are planetary orbits. We can't measure atmospheres, at least not of Earth-sized planets yet. And so we don't know whether there's any water on the planet. We don't know whether it's got an atmosphere that might even permit it. We just know that it at least meets this one requirement that we can measure, is that it's in the right region where liquid water has the potential still.
Now, is there anything about tidal locking? You bring this up sometimes where we have this problem where it's tidally locked. Explain that.
Right. And so, you know, so this, for objects that are orbiting around other objects, when you get close enough, there are tidal forces exerted between the two bodies, and those tidal forces go up dramatically as you get closer. And what that ends up doing is causing a situation where the body that is orbiting, the smaller body that is orbiting, will always have the same face pointing towards the object that it's orbiting. So, for example, on Earth, the moon is tidally locked, that we always see the same side of the moon. Normally, you know, Mercury is tidally locked. It's a little bit odd. It does have a little bit of rotation. It's an odd tidal locking. But if you get things that are orbiting close to our sun would be tidally locked. Well, because this is a dwarf star, it gives off very little radiation. That means that the planets must be very close. In fact, if I can read off the periods here of the seven or the six planets that are known for sure, and the seventh one maybe, it's 1.5 days, 2.4 days, 4.404 days, 6.01 days, 9.2 days, and 12.3 days.
These are the orbits around
how long it takes to get around the star.
All right.
Yeah. So
quite,
I mean,
variable.
Mercury's, I think it's 88 days, if I remember correctly. So, you know, we're way inside the orbit of Mercury here. Yeah. So these things are all whipping around their star very rapidly.
Hang on to your hat.
Yeah. So all of these planets are going to tidally lock very quickly. Now, you may get, you know, because there's planet-planet interactions, that may jostle it a little bit. But in general, these are all going to be tidally locked, which means that the same face of, or the same side of the planet is always going to be facing the star. And, the rotation of Earth actually does a lot to equalize its temperature. So if the same face always, or same side always faces, that side's going to get very hot and the back side's going to get very cold. With atmospheres, again, that has some influence on that. And obviously, you've got to transition from hot to cold. There's going to be a more temperate region on that terminator line there.
A little slice, maybe.
Yeah. So there are all these little things that we talk about where there's still possibility of maybe there could be liquid water there. But again, what I have noticed is that, or as I've read the literature, that we find places where, okay, we can't rule out water there, but they're not real, I'm not real optimistic that they're good, very conducive to water. So say you have, you know, right on that terminus there. Well, if you've got a really hot side of the planet and a really cold side of the planet, you're going to get winds. And so if there is any water there, it's going to continually be swept around to the cold side and then freeze out. You know, so it's not clear to me, or there are some very specific configurations where you can get liquid water still, at least in our models, but it's not clear that those conditions are actually met or that they work necessarily. And one thing that's true about these dwarf stars is that they tend to have a lot of magnetic activity, which removes lighter elements from the planet in a number of ways. So you can get, because you're closer, you get tidal locking, you get thermal emission where the radiation comes in, breaks up the ultraviolet radiation comes in and breaks up water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen, and then the hydrogen escapes off into the atmosphere, off into space. You have other ones where radiation comes in and ionizes things, and the electrons float off into space, and then that creates a positive, or you know, a net positive charge in the atmosphere, which then accelerates carbon, oxygen, nitrogen out into space. And so there's a lot of way in these dwarf stars that in the first few billion years that they're around, that the star is probably going to drive the atmosphere off the planet anyway. So all that to say, the bottom line is this: we found a cool object. I mean, in multiple ways. One, it's a star that doesn't give off a lot of heat, so it's cool in that way. But we've also found this star that is very small, that has lots of planets that are Earth-sized that are in that liquid water habitable zone. And so that's really a remarkable find, and it's close so that we can, in future measurements, actually maybe be able to get some details about what might be in the atmospheres of these planets. And so
future,
that's exciting.
Future as in how long?
These are, I would say, future maybe 5 years type thing.
Oh, really?
So this
okay.
is where maybe with the Hubble Space Telescope, if we do it right, we can actually get transmission or where the light from the star is coming through the atmosphere of these planets and we could see. Or we may find that they have no atmospheres on them at all because they've all been evaporated. You know, these are the types of things that will allow us to begin to take those next steps of not just saying, is it in the habitable zone based on its orbit, but does it have an atmosphere that might actually allow that? And I think once we start finding those sorts of things, we're going to find a lot more constraints and find that places that actually house, really have the potential for liquid water are going to be few and far between if they exist at all.
Are we at the point yet where we can send a probe to a planet like this?
Well, we could always send a probe. It's just a matter of how long it takes to get there. I mean, the fastest spaceships that we have sent are the, you know, like the, I'm drawing a blank, the Voyager 1, Voyager 2. They were launched back in the 70s. It took them about 35 years to get outside the influence of the sun. That's not even half the way to the next star. I mean, so they're still got a long ways to go. So
we'll all be long gone.
Exactly. Even under the most optimistic of future technologies, you're still talking 40 years to get to the closest star. And that's assuming you can solve a lot of technical problems that it's not clear to me that you can. So the idea of actually sending something there, maybe we could send a probe that, you know, we could accelerate up to maybe 10%, maybe 20%, 30% the speed of light. And then we've got, you know, a few decades and we could actually get some imagery of what's there. But the idea of sending humans or any sort of sophisticated large scale or equipment, that's going to be, I don't see that happening in my lifetime.
But bottom line, as you've been articulating, there is a lot of excitement because we have gained a lot of knowledge just by looking at this unusual star and the planets around it.
Exactly.
We haven't had this kind of star before, right?
No, we've not found this many planets around a star and being able to see a star this light. What's remarkable is that it's hard to find Earth-sized planets. Most of these are smaller than Earth size. In fact, I was looking at the masses and it's, you know, 85, 1.4 times 40% the mass of the Earth, 60% the mass of the Earth. So these are pretty light planets, kind of smaller than Venus and a little bit larger than Mars. But yet nonetheless, easily smaller than Neptune and Uranus, which are, you know, have a very gassy or large gassy envelope around them. Mm-hmm. So I think you bring up a very important point is that, often I find in looking at apologetics work that it's easy to get focused on, does this support the evidence for design, and just failing to appreciate that this is remarkable. We can even have this sort of data to talk about.
Mm. Wow. Any other thing you want to bring up, fine-tuning for those who might be a little worried, or is it just a matter of time before we find a planet that is going to be able to support life? You seem very excited about it for good reason. You're a scientist, but let's say there's a layperson there who might be a little concerned. Or should there be any concern for the person out there listening to this podcast?
If your concern is that we're going to find something that shows the Bible's incorrect, then no, there's no reason for concern. And that's not based on what the science says. I mean, there is a little bit of history there, but it's really based on a foundation that if God is who he says he is, nothing that we find in his scripture is going to contradict his revelation in creation. And so in that sense, no. Now, there's a question, I think theologically, it's an open question of did God create life somewhere else or not? I don't think so, but it also wouldn't surprise me if he did. And so that's why I'm excited about a lot of these discoveries, is that if we go out and find, oh, hey, we found planets with liquid water, but we find they're devoid of life. Well, that's a powerful piece of evidence that differentiates between the life's everywhere in the universe and no, life requires such a stringent set of criteria that it only happens where God creates it. And so we can't actually answer that question unless we find places that look kind of like Earth in a substantial way and then be able to ask the question, is there life there? So I'm excited about what we're going to find, because at the end of the day, it's just going to reveal more or help us understand more of God's revelation that he's given in creation.
All right. Well, we appreciate your excitement. Thank you for bringing your comments to this podcast, Jeff. Thank you for your ongoing support. It allows us to bring you up to speed on the latest scientific discoveries and their apologetic value. For Jeff Zwerink, this is Joe Aguirre. Until next time, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at RTB Official.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.